When Pete Early's son became delusional and refused to take his antipsychotic medication, Early concluded that mental health laws were preventing him and other parents from getting help for their children. The leading advocate for changing commitment laws to make it easier for courts to compel treatment for seriously disturbed patients is Dr. E. Fuller Torrey. He's a research psychiatrist specializing in schizophrenia and manic depressive illness who's written 20 books on mental illness and its treatment. He's also president of the Treatment Advocacy Center. I spoke to Dr. Torrey last week. E. Fuller Torrey, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Pete Early, in his book, described a very troubling incident he had with his son who was mentally ill, and it was an occasion relatively early in his son's mental illness at which Pete Early was driving his son back from New York. He clearly seemed to be paranoid, delusional, and he was resisting taking medications which seemed to help his mental illness. Pete Early finally gets him to an emergency room, and the doctor there asks him a few basic questions of orientation, concludes that his son is not in imminent danger to himself or anyone else, and essentially tells Pete Early, there's nothing I can do. Your son doesn't want to take his medication. I can't force him to be treated. I have to release him. And so Pete Early is left in his fury, and his son is left to go off and continue his mental illness. It's a very troubling story to hear. What can a parent do in that situation where they're in an emergency room and the doctor says, if your loved one doesn't want to be treated, there's nothing I can do?
Well, first let me say, Dave, that this is a very common scenario. Pete Early's experience with his son is one being experienced by literally hundreds of thousands of families around the United States who have family members with schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. In terms of what he could do in that situation, is the first thing he should do is to make sure he understands the laws of the state, in this case, Virginia. Does the state have what we call an outpatient commitment statute? Well, Virginia does. It's difficult to use. But the bottom line is, how do you get treatment onto an individual with a brain disease like schizophrenia or bipolar disorder? How do you get treatment when the person is not aware that they're sick, when the person is completely resistant to taking medication, even though the medication is what's going to get them well on it? So, number one, you find out what the state laws are. Secondly, you would, as Pete I think attempted to do, you would try and use whatever leverage you have, both with your family member and also with the treating psychiatrist in this case. And if I were in Pete Early's situation in that, I would say, I will have my lawyer contact you in the morning. If you release my son this afternoon and anything happens to him, I'm going to hold you personally responsible, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Those are all important things. And the third thing is what many of these families end up doing is using the laws to get treatment. In other words, most people like Pete Early's son end up committing a crime, usually a misdemeanor crime. In his case, it was breaking into somebody's home and taking a bath in the bathtub. But indeed, he did have charges against him. Many of the families then end up using that as the way to get leverage to insist that their family member get into a treatment system, and the alternative is going to jail. And these now exist in what we call mental health courts in many of the states, and they have grown up, again, as a way to fulfill this huge vacuum that has evolved over the last 30 years as we change the laws to make it almost impossible to treat people who need treatment but who themselves don't know that they need treatment.
Now, let me back up here. You said that a lot of states, including Virginia, have an outpatient commitment statute. What does that provide for in terms of compelling someone who needs psychiatric help to receive it?
The way it works, Dave, and we have it in the District of Columbia also, and when I was working for many years at St. Elizabeth's Hospital, I used it many times. I would go to court with someone who had, say, been admitted 20 times, and I would say to the judge, Your Honor, this fellow's been in and out of the hospital 20 times. He has no awareness of his illness. He needs to stay on medication. I would like to release him this Thursday on condition that he come back and get his injection every 3 weeks to stay on the medication. That's what's called an outpatient commitment. You're basically saying to the individual, yes, you can live in the community on the condition that you remain on your medication, and we have a way to monitor that you're remaining on your medication. 42 states have statutes like this. 8 states do not. But even in those 42 states that have them, including Virginia, it's often underutilized, or particularly in some states, it is so difficult to use that many families don't use it.
It sounds, though, in a case like that Pete Early was confronted with, where his son did not have a long history of hospitalizations, but clearly was behaving in an irrational, delusional way, that it doesn't sound as if that outpatient commitment statute really would have applied to him.
If he had had no dangerousness, and certainly in Virginia I think this is true, I think that's probably true. But this is because we have changed the laws to make it very, very difficult to treat people who are mentally ill, even if they don't understand that they're mentally ill.
Dr. E. Fuller Torrey, he specializes in schizophrenia and manic depressive illness. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with psychiatrist E. Fuller Torrey. He's president of the Treatment Advocacy Center. Now, you mentioned that a lot of people who are mentally ill will end up committing a crime and thereby entering both the court system and the mental health system that way. And you indicated that if they are arrested for a misdemeanor, that often is an avenue by which a court can compel treatment rather than incarceration.
Right. That's exactly right, and these often go under mental health courts, where these are special courts set up by the state just to handle people who are mentally ill. It is so difficult to get treatment that some of the state officials will tell families, you know, the best thing that could happen to your son or daughter is to get arrested, because then we would be able to get them into a treatment program. But until they're arrested, we can't do anything. It's a really sad state of affairs when that's a situation, and that's exactly the way it is.
Now, if the arrest is for a felony, I mean, let's say you shove someone or hit someone or something that's regarded as an assault, does that disqualify you for this kind of outpatient treatment and instead relegate you to a life of being in prison?
Again, that varies by state. These are state laws, and in some states, the mental health courts will indeed include felonies, and in other cases, they will not. Clearly, if you have a felony charge against you, it's considered much more serious, and often that person will end up in the state prison system and then will be on parole when they are finally released, and the parole will effectively keep them on medication as long as they're on parole.
Do you think that going into the prison system as opposed to a compulsory outpatient treatment clinic can help people with schizophrenia, or is it almost always a bad thing?
No, I have actually seen it be a good thing, and the fact that I can say that I think is very sad. But going into the prison system in some states is the only way now you can get into involuntarily that you can get into a treatment program. I think it's important to emphasize that about half the people with the kind of illness that Peter Early's son had, bipolar disorder and schizophrenia, about half these people are not aware that they're sick. They have damage to the part of the brain that we use to think about ourselves, and therefore they go into the category of people like Alzheimer's disease who don't know that they're sick. But we haven't paid attention to that fact. We've just paid attention to civil liberties and saying nobody who doesn't want to be treated should be treated. And that's why we have so many people with mental illnesses in the jail and also among the homeless on the streets.
These outpatient commitment statutes are, of course, controversial. Your adversary in this debate often is the Bazelon Center for Mental Health Laws, which makes the case that these kinds of statutes represent really a dangerous coercion of the mentally ill and a violation of their rights, and that what you really need is much more extensive funding for the kind of treatment that will help, and that once you indulge society's penchant for locking people up, then you allow them to forget about it and you lose the pressure for real funding and real treatment. What about that argument?
Yes, it's very important to fund adequate services, but if you don't think you're sick, you're not going to use services no matter how adequate they are or how attractive they are, because there's no reason to. Some of my patients from St. Elizabeth are sitting a few blocks from here over in Lafayette Park today, and they really think that they're in touch with the president, and they really think the CIA is beaming messages into their head. It's important to understand that they have no awareness of their illness at all. In terms of locking people up, one of the nice things about the outpatient commitment statutes is it doesn't lock anybody up. What it does is says you can live in the community as long as you stay on your medication, and for that reason, we don't have to lock you up. And we know from the data from outpatient commitment statutes that outpatient commitment accomplishes many things. It decreases rehospitalization markedly. It decreases homelessness. It decreases the number of these people who end up in jail. And it decreases the episodes of violence. So we know it works, and we know it works by leaving people in the community. It's not necessary, in most cases, it's not necessary to lock them up.
And I guess a crucial distinction between that kind of treatment and the typical community-based treatment is that you're not simply giving the patient a bottle of pills, which they are on their honor to take. They must come in and actually get regular injections of the antipsychotic drugs.
There's several ways to do it, Dave. One is you can have them come in and get their injection every 2 weeks, every 3 weeks. That works very well for some. In some cases, you can do as they do for people who have tuberculosis, who refuse to take medicine, and that is have them come to the clinic each day and take their pills in front of a public health nurse or in front of some kind of professional. In other cases, you can monitor their urine. You can do random urine checks, and there are ways to do this to make sure that they are taking the medication. So you can do it in a variety of ways, but we haven't done it very well because we haven't used this very much.
When a patient is committed by the court to one of these outpatient treatment programs that you have described, they show up regularly and get their medications under the supervision of a professional. How does the court ensure that the patient stays with the program?
Well, I can tell you how it worked here in the District of Columbia when I was working at St. Elizabeth's Hospital and used it. Is once I had the approval of the court for an outpatient commitment, I would say to the individual, usually a male, because they're much more inclined not to take medication, I would say you need to come in every 3 weeks for your injection. If you don't come in, I have the right to have a District of Columbia policeman come to your house and bring you involuntarily to the hospital where we can keep you in the hospital. You almost never have to actually do that. But the court does that's part of the outpatient commitment, is you report back to the court if the person doesn't come in, and the court can then approve a law enforcement officer going and bringing the person to the hospital. The remarkable thing is that once they're on outpatient commitment, it usually goes very smoothly. You almost never have to involuntarily hospitalize them.
Of course, these are often lifetime illnesses, and people need to remain on their meds for years and years. How long does the court supervision last in a case like this?
Court supervision will last for varying periods depending on the jurisdiction, depending on the state. 6 months is not unusual. In some cases, it will go for as long as a year. I'm not aware of anywhere it goes longer than a year on it. And in some states, it's only 90 days where you have to go back to court and get it renewed on a regular basis on it. So once the person is on it and doing well on it, then it often tends to just carry itself and will be renewed. And remarkably, many of the people, once they're on it, are quite happy to be on it because they're tired of being homeless, they're tired of being in jail, and they're tired of being victimized, as often happens when you're severely mentally ill.
There are a lot of stories of people with severe mental illness, schizophrenia, who once they are on their medications and stabilized, feel much better, begin thinking rationally, and then forget, you know, what it felt like to be so tormented and conclude, I'm fine. I really don't need my medication. And they may dislike side effects that the medications have. What do you do? What happens in a situation like that where the court has gotten them back on their meds and gotten stable, but they conclude they just don't need them?
This is a very common story, and I think Pete Early can talk about this very articulately because that's what's happened to his son on occasion on it. First, I think we all would like to deny that we're sick. Nobody would like to have an illness like schizophrenia or bipolar disorder. These are lousy diseases on it. And when you're feeling better and on medication, it's not uncommon to say, well, you know, I don't think I really need this. Let me try it without it. That happens all the time, and it's a major problem. Secondly, you mentioned side effects. Side effects is a problem. As a treating psychiatrist, my job then is to find a better medication. Still produces improvement in your symptoms, but without the side effects on it. And fortunately now we have really 8 or 10 medications for both schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. We have many more choices than we had even 10 years ago. It doesn't mean that everyone responds to these medications, but 80-85% of people will respond more or less on it. But this is an issue we have to deal with all the time with the severely mentally ill, because going off their medication is really a very, very common phenomenon.
And so what do you do then?
What I do with my patients is I try and persuade them as best I can. I try and remind them of all the terrible things that's happened when they were homeless or in jail or involved in episodes of violence or being victimized. I work with their families and with their significant others and try and persuade them and remind them of what happens when people stop taking their medication. This is a daily phenomenon for, I think, all psychiatrists and psychologists who have to work with people with severe mental illnesses. You do everything you can to persuade them. Sometimes you can't persuade them, then you have to go to legal mechanisms like outpatient commitment.
And is part of the things you tell them now, you don't want to go back before the judge, do you?
Of course, and especially if they have misdemeanor charges holding over their head, then the court still has leverage on them, and you can say, you know, if you don't stay on your medication, then the judge can send you to jail. That's pretty good leverage, and that's sometimes the only leverage you have. So you use whatever persuasion, coercion, blackmail that you can to try and keep people on the medicine and to keep them well so that they can lead a reasonably normal life.
Psychiatrist E. Fuller Torrey. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with Dr. E. Fuller Torrey. He's a psychiatrist and president of the Treatment Advocacy Center, which seeks changes in the nation's mental health commitment laws. Many of the hundreds of thousands of people who are mentally ill in communities and on the street today, two or three generations ago, would have been in state hospitals, you know, which were, you know, renowned for abuses. What do you think? Should we have more state hospitals than we do, or was it the right thing to close them?
Well, I would, first of all, let me say that 95% of the people who would have been hospitalized 50 years ago are not hospitalized now. Less than 5% of the people, proportion of population, are now in equivalent of state hospitals. So it's a very, very small group. No, we need a few more beds, but most of the people living in the community can live in the community. And in fact, living in the community is preferable to living in a state hospital in almost every case, as long as you stay on your medication. But if you are living in the community without medication and you are homeless, and as a study in Los Angeles, 28% of the homeless severely mentally ill get the majority of their food from garbage cans, this is not exactly a quality life. If, on the other hand, you are in jail and in prison because of your severe mental illness, this is not a quality life either. So that I would say of all the people that we have emptied out, we deinstitutionalized from the hospitals, we've emptied out the hospitals, I'd say about half of them are better off living in the community, but a half are not better off. They're the ones who are roughly 150,000 severely mentally ill among the homeless, roughly 200,000 severely mentally ill now in jails and prisons. This is not a great way to live.
And apart from more effective commitment laws, what should the national priorities be that will help those people?
I think the commitment laws are extremely important. Good services are extremely important. The way we have organized our services and funded our services is really chaotic. Much of the managed care has been very detrimental to people with severe mental illnesses, especially the for-profit managed care. We've really done a terrible job of taking care of these people once they're out of the hospital. The only thing we were good at was emptying the hospitals. Everything that came after that has really been a disgrace.
It's a big question, but do you need a national health insurance program to ensure that mentally ill people get the treatment they need?
Well, most of the severely mentally ill don't qualify for most of the insurance programs we have. And in fact, in a sense, Medicaid, to a lesser extent, Medicare, Medicaid is the national health insurance for people with severe mental illnesses. Medicaid is funding more than half, probably well more than half now, of the services for severely mentally ill people in the United States. And it's not really just a question of money. One of the things that we have found over the years is states that are spending more money do not necessarily have better services. It's how they organize their services. And we know how to organize the services. It's just the way the funding system is set up that we don't do it. But it all goes back to the beginning. If you don't have laws that allow you to treat people who need to be treated, then no matter how good your services are, it's not going to work.
Well, E. Fuller Torrey, thanks so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure, Dave. Thank you.
Dr. E. Fuller Torrey. His book, Surviving Schizophrenia, is now in its fourth edition. You can get more information about the Treatment Advocacy Center at its website, psychlaws.org.